Because I'm going away to session and I needed to pack this morning, today is going to be a Q&A day. So I brought paper and pens for those in the dirt sendo, and then those in the cloud. I'm going to take 5 minutes or so and think of, if you have questions, Buddhist teachings about our practice, and maybe it's something that it's not even so much that you're wondering what my answer is, but you would like the Sangha to kind of discuss it. It can be practical, it can be weird. In the Zendo, you don't have to put your name on your question. And in the cloud, if you can just, send it in the chat generally, but if you kind of don't want everybody to see what your question is, you can chat BWZ Doan directly. And then I'll be the only one who connect your name with your question. Just in case. Go ahead, those in the cloud. Just take a few minutes and go ahead and submit some questions. And I'm not going to get to all of them today. But I always save these and they're inspiration for future talks and stuff too. So talk to you in a few minutes. Let's see, two more just came in here. Oh, this is so exciting. I have like material. Because when I sit down to write a talk, I'm kind of like, I don't know, what do people care about? So then I kind of talk about what I care about, and that's probably gets repetitive. So how do I even decide where to begin? I'll just take one from the cloud and then one from the dirt center kind of randomly. In the order that they came in. Although I'll shuffle the dirt sendo ones. Can't really shuffle the cloud sendo ones. All right. So the first one that came in the cloud, if Buddha directs us to a path that is wishless or without expectation, where does having hope fit in? Where does having hope fit in? Is it wrong to hope? This doesn't seem that loud today. Maybe, and you turn the volume up on the receiver.
Yes, in the back though. No.
No, the receiver box right there. Yeah.
That's why I was
Yes. Testing, testing.
This box?
The shore box, right?
It should have a volume button on it.
Sorry. It's my first day. I'm
I don't. I don't. That doesn't look like it. All right. Well, I'll just try to speak up.
Oh,
Oh.
When you looked at.
Okay. Well. So I am. If the person who submitted this wants to claim it, I can ask a clarifying question. But otherwise, I'm
That's
just
me.
okay.
Ready.
So, what kind of hope are you talking about?
Oh. Well, there's the big hope, existential hope for a better world, hope for peace in the Middle East. There's the big hope. And then there's just hope that your kids are going to be healthy, hope that things are going to get improve on a personal level. So there's a big hope, and then there's individual hope.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think after, I'll give a little response, but then kind of open it up too. So if anybody else has some thoughts. Yeah, because obviously hope, as you're describing it, can sometimes end up kind of causing us misery, right? Because the thing isn't happening the way that we hoped it would or wanted to. Yeah, so there's our practices of this profound acceptance of just the way things are. For example, like Thich Nhat Hanh talked about needing to be able to kind of make your, not make your peace with, but just to face the fact that our civilization may be destroyed. Like, to not live in denial of that, but to face it. And when you do, it's kind of like, I don't know, it can be kind of empowering in a way. It's ironically, we can find a certain equanimity by just facing what is. But then what, right? Like, because then is it like, well, I've accepted our civilization may be destroyed. That doesn't seem like a bodhisattva way of practice. So I don't know. My teacher gave me a phrase because I have a very improving mind, right? I look at things and I'm like, that could be fixed, that could be fixed, that could be improved, that could be improved. And I didn't want to give that up and just like accept things the way they were. But she gave me this way to phrase it, which is, I would really like it if it would make me so immensely happy if human beings changed their ways and found a way to live sustainably on this planet. I would love it if my child was always happy and well adjusted. You know, I don't know. That's it's one way that I've found to approach that. Other, or Betty, you're welcome to speak up as well. But other comments or questions about that? Jimmy.
I just don't think I could live or have any kind of contentment if I didn't have hope. But the point is, I don't depend on the outcome. I mean, that to me, that's the biggest thing. I would be thrilled if I won the lottery. But I'm not going to go into a deep depression every single day because the number that they draw is not my number. That's a bad example. But I mean, we're also, there's so many things that were taught in Buddhism. There's some of this and there's some of this, and it's this way and it's that way. And one of the things we're taught is letting go. And so I can have all the hopes and dreams in the world. I can have a great plan. I planned the most wonderful session last fall. You guys wouldn't have believed it. And I didn't get to go. So the point is that we don't live and die on the expectation. We have to let, excuse me, on the outcome. We have to let that go, to me.
That's super helpful, Yinryu. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think hope in the sense of, I think there's a chance it's going to work out well is important to human beings. You know, I guess we could think of it in terms of just, you know, we need love and social support, and we need shelter and water and food and a little bit of hope, right? And that is partially dependent on our circumstances, but I don't know. I think we can have some effect on the degree of hopefulness that we feel, right? If we recognize that this hope that we're feeling or not feeling is also in some ways empty, right? It's not inherently true or false. Like, I have the probability that we'll pull out of extinction figured out, and it's this likely. I mean, of course, no one has that. So I could be not getting enough sleep, not getting enough exercise. I could be depressive and not taking my medications. I could be doom scrolling, and my hopefulness is going to be decreasing. I can go spend time with Sangha. I can, you know, maybe take action. I can educate myself. You know, there's like news sources that are deliberately positive that we can seek out, and we'd realize like our minds are naturally focused on the problems and just kind of are oblivious in most cases to all of the progress, all of the good things, all of the acts of compassion, and just we focus on the problems. So we can do something about our mind state to make it more hopeful in that way, I think.
Thank you for, I've been thinking about this for a while, so thank you for, I feel better. Yeah. I'm going to remain hopeful. Thanks so much, Domi. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Susan?
You mentioned the Bodhisattva. And if we will be realistic, try to see clearly, it makes it possible to hear the cries of other people and respond effectively. Doesn't hope sustain and fuel the Bodhisattva? Or is that faith? The idea that we can all move along, get to a better place.
Yeah, you're thinking, so in some ways it's just words, right? But yeah, so there's the three-legged stool, right? Of great faith, great doubt, hope. And great determination. Yeah. So, you know, the doubt it being the inquiry, but that the kind of the faith and determination part. But I think it's like, yeah, it can have a little bit different flavor from hope. When I, at one point I realized, you know, very troubled about the climate crisis and just, you know, are we going to be able to make any difference? Can anything that I do make any difference? And at some point I realized, like, not that this, you know, makes me feel great, but I realized if I could save just one little bit of life, it would be worth it. So that's kind of that determination came in, where it wasn't based on like how likely I'm going to be able to fix everything, but just whatever I can do. Thanks for bringing that up. Denny.
Oh, just something very quick and simple, because like Betty, I also have been dealing with that quandary of hope, and I ended up deciding, well, hope maybe can be actually skillful as long as it walks hand in hand with intent. Because I've always been aware that intention is very important in Buddhism, and so I just try, when I'm struggling with that hopeless versus hopeful, I just remind myself, well, sort of what you just said, Domi, that as long as I have sincere intention and I follow through every day, then I can be hopeful.
That actually, I mean, another question that came from the cloud, so I was sticking with the cloud, very related. So so last Sunday you gave a talk on not knowing. This is the first of Bernie Glassman's three precepts for making peace in the world, followed by bearing witness and taking action. I wondered if you could talk about the three concepts as a unit and how they relate to Zen as a whole. Bearing witness and taking action. Interesting. Because my three are bearing witness, taking care, and taking action. Who am I to argue with Bernie Glassman, though? But yeah. So I have to call these, you know, sustainable bodhisattva action. Because the bodhisattva vow, which all of us in Mahayana Buddhism supposedly resonate with, or maybe even have taken this vow, beings are numberless. There's infinite number of beings. I vow to save them all. Before I, you know, retire into nirvana, I'm going to save every last one, which is possible. Like, I mean, they're infinite. So like literally it is impossible. So it's a big aspiration, which if we approach it in the wrong way or without, you know, a fully fleshed out approach, it could just be kind of more overwhelming and lead to more despair, right? Just like, now I'm responsible for all beings and look what's happening. So it's I like to think about the bearing witness as, and when I talked about not knowing last week, it's like that is a kind of a prerequisite for bearing witness, like Susan was talking about, that momentarily, if we're really going to bear witness to something, we have to set aside our stories about it, our plans about it, even our attempts to fix it. And everybody, I think, has experienced this. If you are going through something difficult, or you are with someone who's going through something difficult, if you're just like, well, let's, how can we fix it? How can I fix it? How can I, you know, usually they're like, back off. I just need to be able to be with somebody in my difficulty. So there's a way we have to set all of that aside and just bear witness, which I find to think of this as a specific practice, as useful, as important, really helps me when I'm looking through the news and seeing things, and there's just this sense of like, oh God, to think, because immediately that kind of, you know, empathetic discomfort that we feel, or anger or despair, whatever, is something we want to fix and get rid of by like, well, how should this be solved? Like I say, the stories, how should this be fixed? What can I do? What can't I do? Why is this happening? But momentarily, we can rest in not knowing. We don't know, we may not be able to do anything. We can think about that in the next moment. So there's this bearing witness and letting the reality of it sink in, truly being present with the truth of what's going on. But if we just stayed there, for one thing, we would get exhausted and overwhelmed probably. And I wouldn't say we're not doing anybody any good, but it is pretty much the equivalent of sending thoughts and prayers. And like, all right. And the bodhisattva really does. The bodhisattva really does act for the benefit of beings. You know, in the sutras and the scriptures, it is clear. It's not just that the bodhisattva just says, oh, I just wish you all peace. I mean, they describe the descriptions of bodhisattvas who, you know, go down into hell and stay there and cut through people's delusions and free them from hell. There's bodhisattvas who act really strict and scary to like scare criminals straight. And there's bodhisattvas who like are really, really rich and have a wish fulfilling vase and give people, what do you need? Do you need a bed? Do you need a car? Do you need clothes? Do you need like, and just give stuff, whatever beings need. So like the bodhisattva can manifest in all, a bodhisattva builds bridges, the bodhisattva like solves crimes, the bodhisattva does all kinds of different things. So they really do work for the benefit of beings. So if we just remained in that kind of passive bearing witness state, we wouldn't be fulfilling the bodhisattva vow either. So then there's the taking action part, which is really, really, can for some of us, for many of us, be really, really tough. Because we want to do something that matters. We want to do something that really makes a difference. We don't want our effort to be wasted, especially if it takes a lot of effort or time or money or whatever. But kind of ultimately, we just got to do something. You know, assuming that that's different, what people, different of us are in different positions in terms of being able to take action, whether you're taking action on, you know, in for your favorite political candidate, or you're going out into the woods to remove ivy from trees, or you are, you know, working on the increasing literacy, et cetera, whatever kind of bodhisattva action you are doing, it's just going to be a drop in the bucket. I want mine to really matter. But like, it really is just going to be like, I don't know, feels kind of like pissing in the wind sometimes. But if we all did that, it is going to make a difference. And like, so that's where that kind of great faith comes in. Like, if I keep doing this, if we all keep doing this, if we all just do as much compassionate, beneficial action as we can, things will get better. So that's the taking action part. But I also like the, and I'm not sure how Bernie Glassman deals with this, but I like the acknowledging the taking care part, that we need to take care of ourselves in practical and spiritual ways in order to have the strength to bear witness and take action. So for me, this helps. It helps me feel less like I'm flaking out or being selfish or something when I am doing something that feeds me, like, you know, my regular exercise or playing music, you know, because in my part of my mind, I'm thinking I'm just doing this thing for myself. But if I can think of it in this context with like, and I also am going to have these other components in my life, then I can do this wholeheartedly. This is something I am doing. It's not separate from what I'm doing for everyone and the way I am doing this for everyone. And then the last thing about these three things that I is acknowledging that depending on where you are in your life, there, you're going to emphasize different ones of those three. Hopefully they're all three present to some extent, but if you have young children to care for, if you have elderly parents to care for, if your own health, for instance, is in such a state that like taking care maybe take up like 90% of your life. And that's okay. I mean, you are taking care of yourself. No one has to take care of you if you take care of yourself, or no one else has to take care of your children if you take care of them. So sometimes taking care, it takes up a large space in our life. But when it isn't so much and we have more room, then we can introduce the bearing witness and that taking action part to be a bodhisattva. So I don't know if that really answered the question, because it's kind of a Bernie Glassman's way of looking at it. But any comments, questions, thoughts? All right. Was that? I like that little description, but maybe it doesn't do much for people. Let's see. All right. So another random, how is the teaching of no self related to compassion? And I don't know if the person wants to speak up about it. This is a too risque a question. Let's see. So maybe I would ask, so how is the teaching of no self related to compassion? And I would ask, where does it seem to you there's some place where there's a kind of conflict between those two teachings? Anybody want to? Anybody want to speak up? So I will just so no self. Well, I guess the shortest. Go ahead, Betty.
Something that comes to mind is, you know, we talked about in the past, like the near enemy. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
There's the near enemy of compassion is pity. Is that right? Am I breaking up? I'm sorry. Anyway, that's what comes to mind about the no attachment piece. It's like if you have attachment, you tend to veer on the side of the near enemy or near friend or whatever it's called.
I don't know. I was going to approach this, I guess, from the idea of if I have no real essential self nature in some ways, maybe then who is being compassionate? Because what we usually think about in terms of a compassionate feeling or action is like, I am feeling some empathy with you and I am going to express that or act on that. But then if there's no one here who feels the compassion? I guess in my experience of it's not that there's no self. It's that the self is boundaryless. I actually took that term from Jinryu because Kaz Tanahashi says boundless, which I like, but I actually like boundaryless more. Not the self is like really huge, but the self has there's no boundaries. We really are alive. We really are here. We're just not here the way we think we are. We don't have the fixed boundaries and definitions that we assume are necessary. And so really when we recognize that, compassion is natural because I'm not separate from you. Your pain is my pain, your joy is my joy. So there's not a sense of separation. And we can imagine this, if you're a parent and something, you know, your child, something happens with your child and they tripped or they did something, you're just going to reach out and help them or protect them without, you don't think like, ah, they're so cute. I feel very compassionate toward them. And now I'm going to like, it's just natural. And they say even like, you're compassionate to your own hand if you stick it in a flame and then you pull back. It's so if we extend that sense of self, compassion is just what happens. So in some ways it's a limiting term because, you know, who is compassionate to whom? It's compassion just flows. Anyway, that's what I have to say on the subject. Other comments or thoughts or questions? Denny?
I guess this is a statement and a question. I'm still kind of I have one foot back in bearing witness and another in compassion. And thank you, by the way, for that really nice description of the Bernie Glassman process. That I just love that. And I but I was thinking, you know, in order if you're bearing witness, because I remember Bernie Glassman writing about going to Birkenau and how they, in bearing witness, you're just, in a way, you're letting go of any of your self-conditioning and certainly any of your judgment. And the people there at this extermination camp were able to eventually feel compassion for both sides. And that is something that I try really hard to do, even when I'm watching the news, because I love that idea of watching the news and really going through the exercise of bearing witness, because it does help you watch without feeling like you're just going to crumble with despair and grief. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a roundabout way of going back to compassion and just thinking of it as something that, as you just said, comes naturally. Your heart opens, you're not judging, and you just feel like you've made this real heart connection with somebody else or with this situation.
For me, I really like keeping in mind and dedicating myself to that three-part practice, mm-hmm. because it allows me to bear witness better and open my heart, because there's, and I think many of us will relate to this, there's a part of me like, I don't want to feel compassion for Nazis, right? Like, because if we do, then maybe like we stop judging what's right and wrong. We stop, you know, defending those who need defending. We, you know, like, but I feel like as long as I have committed to this three-part effort, then I can, in this space, open up to compassion, because I know I'm not going to just dwell there. I'm also going at some point to take action where I need to make a call. And I may, like, absolutely not. This can't happen. You need to go to jail, whatever. Like, we know that in another part of our life, we will do the boundaries and we will do the rationality and we will do the right and wrong. To, you know, that's like the, you know, absolute relative. If you just hang out in the absolute where everything is just, that's not it. It's both. Dave.
On the subject of compassion and a sense of self, I'm reminded of studies that have been done on very, very small children, infants, and utilizing objects and toys, they're able to show that pre-verbal children have a sense of compassion. And it's hard to say whether somebody who's pre-verbal has a sense of self at all. But I feel as if compassion might spring from a place deeper than our sense of self.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. I feel like you know, at some point, doing the practice of letting go of all of my views and then discovering that it's the way that it felt to me, that compassion is part of the structure of the universe, I was like, cool. Like, I mean, this isn't something I'm making up. It's not a value system I'm imposing on the universe. This is something I let go. And then I saw, oh, this is just how things work. So here's a great cloud question that I should be able to answer fairly easily. To what extent is accepting the more supernatural elements of Buddhist teachings important for really following Zen? For example, does one need to accept that rebirth to a hungry ghost realm is a literal concept to join a sangha, or is accepting a metaphor for such hunger in all of us sufficient to consider oneself a student of Zen? So good question. And definitely, it depends on the lineage of Buddhism that you are in. In my understanding, all the places that consider themselves Chan or Zen tend toward my approach, my teacher's approach, and whatever, which is definitely you can accept it at a metaphorical level. If you find that you do believe, you believe in bodhisattvas, you believe you can call on Kanzan and she can help you, you are welcome to. If you relate to it as just a metaphor, which I do, or at least I feel very, I'm agnostic, tending toward if I had to put my money down, none of this really literally exists. But I'm agnostic in the sense of like, I don't know, I can't prove that you aren't reborn, and I don't know. But it's not all that important to what I want to teach. It's none of the beliefs in those things are an essential part of at least this lineage's teachings. But, and I'm not sure exactly how it's dealt with, but there are other lineages of Buddhism, particularly Vajrayana, where this whole teaching of rebirth is very central. I don't know that they would kick you out if you said you don't really believe in it, but just it is very, very central to the teachings. So, you know, anyway, you could definitely be part of our Sangha and think of it as just a metaphor. Any other comments or questions? Jinryu.
Well, it's like everything else in Buddhism, which I was saying a few minutes ago, there's literal and then there's literal. And the mention was about hungry ghosts. And shortly after Tsujiki Festival, Matthew Perry died. Now, those who don't know him, he was made famous by being one of the actors in the sitcom Friends that went on for years. If ever there was a hungry ghost, it was he. Because he could not kick any of his addictive habits, and he died because of them. And I also think about some of the stories that we hear. And I'm thinking about a couple of these because of my talk next week, but they are simply stories. They are simply nice things to hear about a loving father trying to get his children out of a burning house. But there is still truth there. There is truth about love and compassion and action. So I don't know about other sects well enough to be able to comment, but I know that that's how I work it into my practice.
Thanks for bringing that up. The way that I think of that is, for most of the teachings that are the kind of more supernatural, if you will, I like to relate to it as like, it's as if it is true. I mean, which is very powerful. It's kind of like, well, I don't believe in rebirth in a really like technical, literal way that has been described by many Buddhists. And yet it kind of seems like it's true. I mean, have you ever like, here's these parents and then they have a kid and this kid is like this, and this kid is like this. How the heck did that happen? Like, it's quite, it's almost as if somebody from a previous life has appeared in this child. So I find it, we can make use of these images and teachings, even if we're kind of agnostic about them. Yoli.
So my question was along the same lines, because recently I've been watching all of these shows, these documentaries on Tibetan Buddhism, and how they pick their next, either their Lama or their, I forget what their other names are, in some of these monasteries. And it is quite fascinating, because the one in particular, and I just can't remember which one it was, he died in 1980s, and he left a note that they finally found, telling and instructing where they would find him again, what year, where, and the name of his parents. God, it all came through, and I'm thinking, wow, that's very interesting, because then they went out and they found this kid and they dragged him back to the monastery, right? But poor kid. But like, the kid was like super content. He left his parents. He said, see ya. But he came from this nomadic group of, you know, this nomadic family. And I just think to me, it was like incredibly fascinating and incredibly like, whoa, how did he like was able to, in this note that he wrote prior to his death, say this that all came through? Or did we as people make it come through? You know, it's just really interesting. I just read the book Sapiens. I don't know if anybody's read it. And I find that one very interesting, because he makes a point that the reason that our species, the state of Homo sapiens, lasted is because of our ability to imagine. And so everything outside of us is imagined, laws, cultures, ways of doing things, it's all imagined. So I'm not really sure how to tie all this together, other than I've been thinking about this a lot, is like, how, I mean, all of this is imagined. And so does our imagination make this happen, or is it true? I don't know. Anyways.
I was attracted to Buddhism because it did not require you to believe anything. Although, like, there's things you have to, in order to practice, you accept it on faith, but the idea is that you can verify this for yourself at some point. And, you know, kind of whether rebirth is true is not something I anticipate being able to verify for myself. So I never wanted, like, you know, I was briefly Catholic, and just kind of the list of like, and we believe, and like, and then the faith is based on these beliefs, which then, like, you kind of have to hold on to. And what if they're, if you start worrying that they're not true, then everything starts falling apart. Whereas our practice, like, is not based on anything like that. But, you know, like, in terms of that, you know, what are the implications, even if we're like, who knows about llamas and whether all of this stuff is true, but if, like, what if it was true, what it says is, you know, everything that we do matters. Our life energy does not end at death. And we see how, if we've hurt people and destroyed things, and we leave awake, you know, whether this little person gets reborn and goes into another body, who knows? But if we've been very, very generous and kind, we leave that kind of positivity. So it goes beyond our death, and the I don't know a lot about Vajrayana, but I know that when they are not everyone necessarily does this, but they will train for death. They will train for at the last moment, and there's many practices that they do this, so that at the last moment you can let go. And that's, it's very technical. Your spirit comes out the top of your head. You learn how to navigate the in-between realm, and you learn how to make choices. And the idea for most of us is to let go and not be reborn. But then the lamas, they have enough skill to navigate this bardo realm, and then go, this is where it would be useful for me to be reborn. And they're reborn to be of benefit to other people, not reborn as most of us would be, because so we get reborn because of karma, because of our unresolved stuff or our unresolved desires, where they're choosing where to be reborn. Again, I think it's kind of beautiful, whether you literally believe it or not. Let's see. Got five. Natalie.
I was just going to say, my question was, what does the Buddha say about reincarnation?
Oh, good.
What do other Buddhist teachers say about reincarnation? So I don't know if we've addressed it.
Oh, cool.
Did the Buddha have some statements too?
So Natalie said her question, which I didn't actually pick up in here, was about what are the Buddha's teachings on reincarnation? And the Buddha himself, I tend to think of it as he was born into and taught and lived in a cultural and religious milieu where this was all assumed. This was the way everybody thought that the world worked, was that you were reborn. This was apparently, I think this is pretty cool, one of the theories is that the ancient Indians started studying astrology. And they astronomy, sorry. And they noticed the patterns. They noticed the vast, vast patterns in space, and began to perceive that time is incredibly long and repeats in some way. So they had that kind of led to this idea that there's this cyclic thing of rebirth. So when you died, your spirit went out, and actually we have Wheel of Life shows the six realms of existence. There's heaven and hell, the human realm, the fighting demigod realm, the hungry ghost realm, and the beast realm. And that you see people on this mandala of the Wheel of Life, you see people, they're dying, and then they kind of you see them going around and around. Where are they going to end up reborn? Which realm are they going to end up being reborn? And they all go before Mara, the Lord of the Dead, who kind of judges, where are they going to be reborn? But he does not judge them. He holds up a mirror. So he holds up a mirror. So based on how you lived, that's where it determines where you end up. So you might end up a beast, a hungry ghost. You might end up in the heaven realm for a while, but you don't stay there. You go round and round. So the idea was that you never stay in any realm forever, but you're not stuck in any realm forever either. There are ways out of each realm. And it's generally through practice and through forgiveness or overcoming anger or hatred or whatever. And then the goal of not just the Buddha, but other spiritual seekers of their time, because they looked at this whole process negatively. I think this is very interesting. I think this is something that culturally, socially has changed. I mean, I think we all can admit that life can be difficult, that there's lots of suffering in the world, but we don't tend to look at it as oh my God, I'm going to be reborn again and again and again. But if you just kind of think of it as, you know, you go ignorantly again and again and again, and every time you have the same hopes and the same loves and the same losses and the same, like, you know, old age, disease, and death. And like, so it was okay if you wanted to be reborn in this cosmology. It was okay. If you just want to try to be reborn in a better realm, that's fine. But kind of the ultimate goal, if you're a real spiritual athlete, was not to be reborn at all, was to like be liberated from this whole cycle. So that was, I mean, the Buddha definitely talked about it. It was definitely, you'll find it in the original teachings, talking about these different realms and rebirth and whatever. So, I mean, there's a guy out there, Stephen Batchelor, who's written some good books. I think he was involved in Vajrayana or something, but he's written some books about basically Buddhism does not need the teaching of rebirth. And there may be people who disagree with him, but I agree with him in the sense that I don't think, I, even though it has some beautiful implications, I don't find it essential to the Zen teachings. For instance, I feel like if what I taught and what we studied here, we never, ever, ever mentioned rebirth, I think we'd be fine. So.
For myself, I find it a comforting thought, the rebirth.
So she was saying, yeah, that finds it actually comforting, which.
Versus annihilation, or I don't know, I'm in the Buddha.
Yeah. But the idea of the, and just so we're at 12:16, but I'll just address, like, okay, so what's the Buddhist idea of, like, well, is it annihilation then when you get off this wheel of life? Well, we'll have to see, you know, that holds up a whole thing. Like, I should just do a whole Dharma talk on, like, death. Mm-hmm. What's the Buddhist view of death, the Zen view of death, you know? What is the end? And just, I guess, the most direct way to answer this shortly is, for me, you know, when, like I said, I was talking about the beginning, this sense of self as being boundaryless. So when I am perceiving things that way, like the sun and the moon and you and the songbirds and are all part of myself. So like the end of this body is not that big a deal. So it's not, yeah. So it's like there's no, and there was no fixed person here to be destroyed. So when we really recognize that there's no, this inherent sense of self is actually an illusion, and, you know, the self is boundaryless, then our fear of annihilation goes away. Simple, huh? All right. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for submitting your questions. And I will take all these. So whoever's host, give me a chance to get this stuff out of the chat before I close the computer. All right. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramis.